and welcome to the Belt and Road podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I am your host, Eric Mike Sterino, joined again by Juliet Liu. Juliet, how's it going?
Hey, Eric. Nice to hear from you. I'm here in New York State enjoying the weather.
Yeah, it's been really optimal here. I've already carved the pumpkin and I'm into the seasons here now. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners, if you want to stay up to date on the latest news, research, analysis, and discussions on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Great. China's relationship with the Middle East is a complicated one. Historically speaking, China has not had particularly strong links to the Middle East, but in recent decades, that relationship has evolved considerably. Our guest today, Lucille Greer, writes that for the past 30 years, China has been cultivating closer ties with the Middle East, driven by a need for energy resources to power its rise. Indeed, China is the world's second highest consumer of petrol just after the US, and it's the top importer. And 50% of its petroleum comes from the Middle Eastern region. China's relationship with Middle Eastern countries is further complicated by the fact that countries like Iran and others have complicated relationships themselves with the US and its own allies. And those tense relationships become a defining fault line in not only global geopolitics, but also in China's relationship with the Middle East. Here with us today to discuss China's growing relationship with the Middle East is Lucille Greer. Lucille is a Schwarzman Fellow at the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States. She's conducted policy research in both the Middle East and China. Her current research project with the Wilson Center is entitled Bridging the Gulf, China's Navigation of the Saudi Arabian Rivalry. Her interests include authoritarianism, security, intervention policy, sectarianism, and American and Chinese foreign policy. She has published extensively, which we've really enjoyed reading in the last week or so, her research with the Wilson Center's Middle East Program, West Point's Modern War Institute, the Middle East Institute, and The Diplomat. Lucille also has a master's degree in global affairs from Tsinghua University. So Lucille, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about our conversation today.
Yeah, we are too.
Yeah. Lucille, so great to be able to read all your work. Can you tell us a little bit about your work at the Wilson Institute and also your path on researching the relationship between China, the Middle East, and the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. So I am one of the Schwarzman Fellows at the Wilson Center, and I'm based at our China program, which is the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States. But while I sit on the China desk at Wilson, my background expertise is actually in Middle East politics. So I speak Arabic, I've lived in Jordan and Saudi Arabia, traveled the region in general. That's where I first got my start. But then, you know, the longer you sit on this topic, more and more recently, you hear about China and the Middle East, China and the Middle East. And, you know, I was deeply intrigued by that. And as someone who works on the Middle East, we really value learning the language, learning the culture, learning the history. So then this opportunity came up for me to go study at Tsinghua University in Beijing. And I really wanted to sink my teeth into the China topic in a similar way, rather than just sort of treating it as like an extracurricular activity. So I went to Beijing and really started digging into this research. I did my master's research on Chinese engagement in Middle East conflict resolution. And now I'm based here at the Wilson Center in DC, where I wear many hats on the China-Middle East topic, but my main project is studying one of China's diplomatic tricks in the region, namely befriending all these different sides in terms of rivalries. So we can think about China in all these different, very, you know, entrenched animosities. Israel-Palestine, Qatar and the bloc against it, Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it's maintained pretty stable and, you know, relatively productive relationships with all of them. So I'm taking a really close, sort of zoomed in look at the way that China manages the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran, a rivalry that has truly impacted the region since 1979. So yeah, that's sort of what I'm up to. And hopefully it'll be a monograph I'm publishing in early 2021, but I'm also just generally looking at China and the Middle East, different countries in the region, economics, security, all that kind of stuff. Because this topic, you know, you could take it in any direction you want. And it's particularly interesting given that the Middle East is quite a sensitive topic for people in the US and particularly in US policy, given how much time and money that we've sunk into that region. And it's quite, you know, it's quite emotional for a lot of people. So I think the intersection is just dramatically interesting. And I think it will only get more important as time goes on.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, we're going to post, obviously, all the articles that we did kind of read when we were preparing for our chat when we put up the podcast. But yeah, Lucille has just written a huge range of articles on China's presence in the Middle East. Now, if we kind of zoom out a little bit from your focus on Saudi Arabia and Iran, what are China's broader interests in the Middle East specifically? What has brought China into this kind of increasing engagement, as you say, in the last 30 years?
Sure. So China has four primary interests in the Middle East that sort of are driving its engagement with the region. The first one I'd have to say is geostrategic connectivity. So obviously with the conversation of the BRI, it is the physical linkage between Asia, Africa, and Europe, and then of course has these really deep connections in Central Asia as well. So it's sort of this linchpin that is an inevitable part of the BRI conversation. But this thinking of the Middle East as part of a geostrategic connectivity issue, it predates the BRI. This is an issue that China's been worried about since, I think, even World War II. There are writings about China being worried about being surrounded by enemies, you know, and then we saw Chiang Kai-shek's government sent a delegation of Muslims to conduct Hajj in Saudi Arabia, and so did the Japanese-occupied Manchurian government. So this is something that's been on the strategic mind of China for longer than the BRI. And right now, I think the terminology on what the Middle East is the greater neighboring area. So this is something that China has on its mind. And then the second interest, and the most obvious one, I think, is energy. So we can talk about China as the second highest consumer of crude oil in the world and the world's largest net importer, which first happened in 2017. It surpassed the United States. So this is pretty important for China. 70% of China's oil comes from foreign sources, and that number is only projected to rise to around 80% by 2030. So mathematically, you can think about China and the Middle East as sort of being destined for each other, with one side having an oil economy and the other one needing oil. But at the same time, they're also looking to keep a diverse portfolio for oil for their own energy security. So one thing is the Middle East does play a role with that. So China does not rely entirely on Russia or other countries for its oil. Its Persian Gulf partners are a little bit of a disadvantage, though, because there aren't any direct land pipelines to China. It has to navigate two naval choke points to oil to travel from the Persian Gulf to China. So it has to go through the Strait of Hormuz and the Strait of Malacca. And those are two parts of the world where China is chronically worried about its access to oil or even other goods getting choked off. So that's just part of the equation here. The third interest is international status. So China, as we know, is a rising power, or perhaps we should describe it as a risen power. So they fought long and hard to get the kind of recognition that they deserve on the international stage. And it's hard to deny that there's this element of prestige to be had when it comes to being an international actor in the Middle East. So putting yourself as a state out there as a problem solver in the MENA region or the Middle East and North Africa region can be quite advantageous to your international brand. We've seen some of this kind of rhetoric or virtue signaling from China as a problem solver in the Middle East for the past few years. So one example of that is that in 2017, China put out a four-point peace plan for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It was basically the same as the Arab peace plan. Did it do anything to change the conversation in that, you know, long drawn out conflict? No, but it did start conversations about China being a mediator and a problem solver in an arena where the United States has historically failed. So it's able to put itself out there as a mediator and then also nibble at the United States in the region, which is something I'm sure will come up again in our conversation. And then fourth and finally, I think China's other interest in the Middle East is violent extremism. So when China isn't thinking about oil or the BRI, the next thing it thinks of is the political chaos that the region is stereotypically experiencing. This pretty much accounts for China's limited outreach to the region compared with, say, Africa or Latin America. It doesn't want to be bogged down. It considers itself to have learned from the example of the United States. So one specific area where China is worried about violent extremism is that it's worried about its own Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. China is deeply insecure in that part of the country. Specifically, it's concerned that Uyghur fighters will travel to Syria, learn the tricks of the trade in that conflict, and then bring it home and deploy it there. This is one threat that's also politically been over-exaggerated by Syrian authorities to try and keep their relevance alive to Chinese officials. So we have sort of these four issues all converging together, and those, I think, are the main things that are driving China in the region.
Yeah, you've maybe covered a few of them just with that answer, but what are some of the recent hallmarks or watershed key events on China's rising engagement with Middle East countries? And past a discursive level, has the Belt and Road changed China's relations or role in the region?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Belt and Road is one of the, if not the, watershed moment in recent years in Chinese Middle Eastern relations. I think it's one of the things it's done is it's given momentum to relations other than oil trade, because it has a set of ready-made sort of a bracket of talking points that are offered to all parties involved. I'm sure you hear this from other guests on the podcast. The BRI is a pretty nebulous concept, and sort of you can slap the BRI label on a lot of projects and then chalk it up to win-win cooperation or East-West connections or all those kinds of things. So that is definitely happening in the Middle East as well. So it's given this very rhetorical buttressing. And then on the flip side of that, which is really sort of neat in how these relationships align, you have a lot of Arab Gulf countries announcing so-called visions for economic development. So Saudi Arabia has Vision 2030, the UAE has a Vision 2021, and so on and so forth. So while Gulf countries seem rich, at just a glance, the problem is they're entirely too dependent on the oil market, which is subject to the normal fluctuations of petropolitics. So these countries' national budgets all rely on oil being around $80 or $90 a barrel, where the price of oil right now is hanging around $40. So they've been running deficits for years, and it doesn't seem like that will alleviate anytime soon. So they've all announced these really ambitious economic diversification plans that put an emphasis on foreign direct investment, something that China is in a place to grant in alignment with the BRI. So there's a natural synthesis between these Gulf development plans and the BRI, which both Gulf and Chinese officials have been really happy to talk about. There's actually an official joint docking committee to align the BRI and Vision 2030. I think another event we can talk about in recent years for Chinese Middle Eastern relations is in 2016, President Xi did what was essentially a grand tour of the Middle East. And China released its only white paper on its policy with the Arab world, which lays out a lot of their goals and talking points. I highly recommend everyone go and read it. It really will tell you in black and white what they're thinking about when they're looking at the Arab world. And then also, I think in 2017, as I mentioned already, China surpassed the U.S. as the world's largest net oil importer due to the shale revolution here in the U.S., which meant that we just didn't have to import as much oil. So that doesn't mean that companies like Saudi Aramco and others are sort of overthrowing the U.S. in their interests. There's still a lot of U.S. involvement in downstream revenue from oil. So, for example, Saudi Aramco actually owns the largest oil refinery in the United States, if not North America. It's the Motiva refinery in Port Arthur, Texas. So it's not entirely changing the conversation about oil, but it's really significant that China is eating up more of this oil than the U.S. Well, there's still those really corporate linkages and technical know-how linkages between Western international oil companies, IOCs, and Arab oil companies. I think that those are the hallmark moments of the latest Chinese Middle East relations.
Yeah, Lucille, so one of the articles you have is called Solidarity and Strain. It's published in April this year. You talk about this outpouring of mutual solidarity between MENA countries and China, and that's kind of both along the lines of aid, but also you talk about the way that media coverage of China is happening in Middle Eastern, North African countries in the wake of COVID. And you kind of flag that this shows that there's mutual solidarity between the regions. Has that lasted since you wrote in April? And also, has it translated into more than just slogans and an initial offer for aid in dealing with COVID? Has it translated into other longer lasting forms of support from China to the Middle East?
Sure. So like in many parts of the world, China has a media apparatus for its messaging to the Arab world. The People's Daily has had an Arabic website since, I think, 2001. And then CGTN, formerly CCTV, has had one since 2008. So this whole Arabic language state media apparatus was just deployed to the Arab world and had all this kinds of messaging, all these articles about, you know, Arab people living in China being confident in Chinese leadership and the handling of the crisis, that kind of rhetorical outpouring. Then you also saw Gulf countries sending aid back to China in the early days of the crisis. I think one of the more interesting forms of messaging that we've seen is very understandable tactic of messaging, the support and solidarity with beleaguered medical workers, particularly in the early days of the crisis when it was primarily just Chinese workers before the world's medical workers started working on this. And so there's this really interesting example of this music video called Dhul al-Malaika, which just means Shadow of the Angels. And it's, you should go on YouTube and look it up. It's fascinating. So it's this both Arab and Chinese singers singing in Arabic about medical workers. And it comes with pictures of Chinese medical workers working very hard, trying very hard to take care of their patients. You know, there's a cute baby in the picture. And then also China sending off medical teams and equipment to the Arab world. And you can see, I think one of the planes in the video says it's from Iraq. So that kind of solidarity was very prevalent in the early days of COVID.
I love that example. We have to get a link to that to put in our show notes. It sounds
you do.
Amazing.
It's a watch for sure.
Yeah.
So particularly the Gulf countries are still riding high on that level of COVID cooperation with China. So we've seen the UAE in particular is pretty big on cooperation. They're actually rolling out human trials of a Chinese-made vaccine. So is Saudi Arabia. The Shenzhen-based biomedical company BGI did roll out some COVID testing in the Middle East, which actually at the time was criticized by U.S. officials. It was a pretty interesting development and one of the ways the U.S. is particularly nervous about China's COVID diplomacy in the Middle East, as this is another chance for China to sort of show itself as capable. I think there's, again, this acknowledgement from a lot of leaders and thinkers in the Middle East that China has handled the COVID crisis better than perhaps the United States, which I think lots of people share that opinion. There's actually, there's a great War on the Rocks piece about this by Andrew Labor on how the Saudi press and Saudi press figures have sort of described it. And it's fascinating. So this, again, is the result of China really sending out this messaging and churning out all this state messaging in Arabic to convince people that they've done a good job. So is a lot of COVID diplomacy just rhetoric and slogans? Yes, but that's sort of just China in the Middle East for you.
Interesting. Really interesting. Going forward, you know, much of your research and your writings focus on, you know, it's at the level of international relations or formal diplomacy and aid. And many other countries where we have guests on the show, research in Southeast Asia, throughout Africa. You know, many countries, though, Chinese entities working with political elites within that country, while there's popular movements within the country that rise against Chinese influence or have anti-China sentiment. What can you say about popular perceptions of China within different Middle Eastern countries?
So first off, I'm not from the region, so that's sort of a general caveat to whatever I say on this topic. I haven't lived in the Middle East since 2018. But sort of my own observations and then what other scholars from the region have written is that they're very much on each other's periphery. I mean, I don't think China is at the forefront of most Arab people's minds or Persians or whatever particular demographic subset of the Middle East that you choose to talk about. So we also need to remember that the Middle East itself is sort of a kind of a British construct in that it's very difficult to talk about wide perceptions there. Middle East, East being sort of East Asia and China, and then the middle between Britain and China is the Middle East, and that's why the Middle East is called the Middle East. So even if we just zero in on the Arab world, which is where I have language expertise, there are still pretty big differences in people's opinions. So one tool is the Arab Barometer, which is a really fantastic survey that looks over several countries in the MENA region. It's in partnership, I think, with Princeton University. And in its most recent iteration, the fifth wave, China ranked most favorably of the world powers in most of the countries they surveyed, higher than both Russia and the United States for both closer economic ties and foreign assistance, which I think is pretty telling.
Wow, yeah.
And people from the Middle East, on the flip side of, you know, this conversation about Chinese people in China being on the periphery of people in the Middle East, I think also that Middle Eastern people are on the periphery for Chinese people. I don't think they think about the Middle East too much. It doesn't appear in the news quite a lot, certainly not in state news that much. I think they view the Middle East and its people very similarly to how people in the US generally view it, as a, you know, a far-off, war-torn, complicated place. So I also do think that there's a level of admiration there of China being good at business. And people are often very happy to have an alternative to the US, you know, which has its own very complicated history there. However, sometimes Chinese and Arab officials rub each other the wrong way. There's this anecdotal story about a Chinese official from the embassy, I think this was in Saudi Arabia, a Chinese official in Saudi Arabia had a meeting scheduled with people from the oil ministry in Saudi Arabia. And as is Saudi business custom, sometimes it will be hours before you actually get into the meeting that you were scheduled for. That's just the way that business culture works there, and it's just to be expected. The Chinese, however, were particularly incensed by this incident. So on the flip side, when I think the Saudi oil minister visited Beijing, they kept him waiting for hours. And then when they finally met, they only served him water in a paper cup. So a pretty dramatic fallout. This is just one issue where culture clash is normal between countries, but punctuality, I think, is very different between these two parts of the world. There's also, I think, a perception that things made in China are quote unquote cheap and not as good. I think European and American brands are still preferred. That may change, particularly with the rise of quality Chinese brand name products. And I think Huawei is rolling out some very ambitious plans to have good smartphones and be popular in the market share of telecommunications. And also, I think in public opinion in Iran was quite negative in the wake of the leaked draft comprehensive strategic partnership. We're going to talk about this later, I'm sure. But Iran's deal with China got leaked on social media. And there was a firestorm on Iranian social media. They were so upset. They thought that, you know, the country was selling out to China, to the degree that Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, had to publicly debunk the theory that Iran was selling Kish Islands to China. So when it comes to public opinion about China in the Middle East, it's sort of a mixed bag. We have these numbers from the Arab Barometer and others and general perception that China is viewed more favorably than the United States. Not particularly hard, given the United States' very loaded history. But this is an advantage that China is happy to play upon as alternative to the US in the region.
That gets into one of the bigger questions that I had. China clearly has its own independent relationship with Middle Eastern countries, all of them different from each other, but that relationship is inevitably influenced by the gravitational pull of US geopolitics. US's tense relationship with China, I'm sure, affects the Middle East a lot and vice versa. In what ways do you think China-US tensions and US-Middle Eastern tensions influence China's relationship with the region? And I guess my larger question is there a danger of over-inserting US influence into our interpretations of, sometimes I think we tend to insert China-US tensions into China's relationship with so many other regions of the world, but perhaps it's appropriate in the Middle East, or perhaps you like to toe certain lines.
This is a very valid question. I mean, it's the Middle East. We have to spend some time thinking about US geopolitics and foreign policy. So with the current US-China tensions only getting worse, it's likely we'll see ripple effects on the US and China in the Middle East. There's the idea that this could become an arena for great power competition, really, I think, only became feasible lately, because for a long, long time, China has really relied on the US security umbrella in the MENA region. China, of course, you know, has a couple of aircraft carriers. It's got a new naval logistics base in Djibouti. I mean, that just completely pales in comparison to the US security installation in the Persian Gulf and the wider Middle East. So China just does not have interest in replacing the United States. It has neither the political willpower or military capability to do so. But what we're seeing increasingly is it's almost like the Middle East is a place where the US can sort of pick a fight with China based on just how nervous people in the US generally are about a region where the US has committed a great deal of, you know, resources, blood and treasure, all that kind of stuff. But I think China will always prioritize its relationship with the United States over the Middle East. I mean, we've seen this time and time again. Whenever the US is particularly unhappy with what China is doing in the region, it only needs to apply pressure on Beijing, and then Beijing will back down. We've seen this in many, many cases. For example, Iran and China signed a nuclear cooperation deal in the 1990s, and then the U.S. told them absolutely not. And so China backed out of that deal. China sold surface-to-surface missiles to Saudi Arabia in the 1980s, and it became public in 1990. The U.S. set about chastising China and Saudi Arabia both for that interchange. The truth is that the U.S. will always be a bigger political, economic, I mean, whatever metric you have, rather than the Middle East, which its utility so far is energy, international prestige, some geostrategic connectivity. But I think maybe other areas along the BRI are a higher priority, also because they're in China's direct neighborhood. One thing that I think U.S.-MENA tensions do in this sort of melting pot is that they make China an attractive alternative in a lot of places. So China will happily accuse the U.S. of mucking around in the Middle East to deter China's rise. So actually, we saw some conspiracy theories around the time of the Arab Spring and the first Gulf War that the U.S. was interfering with the international oil pipeline to prevent China's rise, which I think is really interesting. But China and the Arab world both share a great love for conspiracy theories, I think also when it comes to the U.S. So that's just interesting to hear about. To your point about over-centering the U.S., in this topic, I think that's absolutely a concern. Oftentimes, I think natural interests and bilateral relationships get turned into great power competition when that's just not quite the case. Again, because so much of this relationship between China and the region is based in rhetoric, people are quite happy to sort of go and take that rhetoric and run with it and then base their analysis on that. But you have to be a little bit more patient and a little bit more skeptical and really pull apart for the material commitments, because that's what will tell you, you know, the true nature of what's going on.
I really like that distinction between the rhetoric and the material commitments. It's something that's, I think, as China becomes so big on the Belt and Road, that a lot of analysis by people who aren't familiar with China kind of can take really hyperbolic statements that Chinese diplomats like to make, and especially like how concrete numbers tend to be when Chinese businesses or politicians announce new campaigns. Yeah, it has to be taken a little bit with a grain of salt and dug into before it's taken seriously.
Let's talk about a very specific relationship, China's relationship with Iran. First, can you describe the ways in which China has acted as an advocate for Iranian interests on the global stage? And also, you mentioned in the last answer about the China-U.S. 25-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. You know, as somebody who doesn't follow Middle East, China, Iran relations that much, this was even something I heard about, that there was this major plan. But you co-wrote a piece for the Wilson Center that said that this secret agreement is not really much new. Can you go into that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So this made the rounds of headlines, and unfortunately people picked up on a great deal of, again, the rhetoric and not looking into the material commitments. So China has different sort of levels that it has for its relationships in the Middle East and broadly in the world. It has partnerships, it has strategic partnerships, and it has comprehensive strategic partnerships. It does not have alliances. In June, there was a document that was leaked. It was a Farsi document that said draft comprehensive strategic partnership. And it basically was a draft of the language of the comprehensive strategic partnership that China has with Iran. China also has a comprehensive strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, who's Iran's, you know, sort of avowed nemesis. So that caused a lot of interest. I mean, within Iran, people were picking it up, and then international news picked it up. And then we sort of were hearing about this forthcoming axis in defiance of the United States of Chinese-Iranian power aligned in, you know, a troubling partnership. But the fact of the matter is that China first signed a comprehensive strategic partnership deal with Iran in 2016, on the same trip that President Xi signed one with King Salman in Saudi Arabia. And so this is just a continuation of those negotiations and those talks. And that's basically what the document itself said. But then you saw, you know, a lot of news articles running figures like, oh, China has promised $400 million in investment in Iran, and China and Iran are going to have joint shared air bases, I think was another claim coming from this draft partnership. But actually, in our report, we have an English translation of the draft comprehensive strategic partnership. And I highly recommend everyone go read it. I think it's the only English translation out there. And if you look at it, it's pretty standard, boring Chinese diplomatic language. You know, there's lots of win-win cooperation, East-West cooperation. Of course, there's talks about 5G communication sharing. There's about joint naval drills, all that kind of stuff. But it's not a grandiose sort of ploy that it sort of has been made up to be. And this is what happens oftentimes when we're talking about Chinese-Iranian relationships, because naturally, if two countries that the U.S. is not particularly friendly with get together, people are going to be nervous. So China, for a long, long time, has played the role of sort of Iran's advocate on the international scene. Whenever the UN Security Council has voted to impose sanctions on Iran for its nuclear program, China, just about every time, has either said we shouldn't do it or we should only impose moderate sanctions. I think earlier, before the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, referred Iran's case to the UN Security Council, China objected very strongly that it wanted to keep it out of the UN Security Council. We also saw this again in COVID, with China calling on the United States to temporarily lift sanctions to sort of alleviate Iran, who is a country that truly sunk under the weight of the COVID crisis. But the thing is that, again, this is a lot of rhetoric. China has voted almost every single time on the UN Security Council to impose sanctions. Lots of these votes go through unanimously. There was a bit of a dust up earlier this year. There's a UN arms embargo on Iran that, you know, while it doesn't name conventional weapons, it's often interpreted to mean conventional weapons. And it actually expires later this month. And so the U.S. voted to extend the embargo, whereas the rest of the UN Security Council basically abstained. And then China and Russia voted against. This is, you know, a pretty dramatic moment for China, where it voted against the U.S. on the UN Security Council when it came to the Middle East, when generally it prefers to be much more strategic and restrained in its commitment. So there's this question of, you know, perhaps will China step in as a major arms exporter to Iran as soon as the arms embargo lifts? And the answer is probably no, because Iran, again, even before COVID, it was dealing with its own economic crises, and it doesn't particularly have a lot of money to spend on weapons, and the kinds of weapons that Iran wants to buy are ones that China's not good at, namely jet engine weapons, fighter jets. So that's what is happening on that end of the conversation. And then, does this rhetorical effort translate into direct benefits for China? I think it's definitely true that it has greased the wheels of Chinese-Iranian trade and investment, but China has encountered its own difficulties there. I mean, particularly in the energy sector, we have all these stories of Chinese companies going in to, say, the South Pars gas field or the Azadegan oil field, and then its companies get accused of foot dragging by the Iranian oil ministry, and then they get kicked out. So they have a very turbulent relationship. Iran in general has a relatively hostile climate to foreign business, because up until, I think, 2017, most energy deals were put forth in the form of buyback contracts. So what that means is that a foreign company can invest in a specific field or enterprise and searching for oil, and then up to the point where I think they refine it, at which point the Iranian National Oil Company is able to buy back the enterprise from the foreign company. So it's entirely plausible that a foreign company could spend a lot of money up front on a project and then just not even recoup the loss based on that. It's not a very attractive form of contract to have. So China's run into that. And then also when you add sanctions on top of that, it's truly a messy business. So has it helped them in that front? Yes, you'd think there would be some gratitude. There's this one video of this one CNPC, Chinese National Petroleum Company contractor in 2016 that, you know, that Iran will be grateful to Chinese companies for sticking with them during the sanctions period. But I don't think we've seen that play out quite as perhaps those Chinese oil companies had hoped.
Yeah, it's super complex. But is this, it was your article on Iran that was also talking about the importance of shipping routes through Middle East adjacent areas, that China's access to oil is also important in terms of the rise of piracy in that area. That was super interesting.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the ways that China is able to sort of insert itself into Middle Eastern security while still promoting its sort of non-interference rhetoric, is that it goes on these very non-controversial pretexts like anti-piracy work or counterterrorism drills or whatever. And those are absolutely things that China has interests in. China does a great deal of shipping business. China, again, gets its oil through the Strait of Hormuz. This has led to China's first foreign military base actually being on the coast of Djibouti, which is East Africa, right across from the corner of Yemen, and just like a little bit of a sail away from the Strait of Hormuz. So China has been involved in anti-piracy operations, and then this base is ostensibly a place where the People's Liberation Army Navy can do the logistical things you need to sort of keep a ship supplied for missions like that. And so this is sort of the forefront of China's security interests in shipping. And then I think this also plays into the conversation of China and ports around the world. China, I believe, is invested in the Duqm port in Oman. I think they're definitely involved in that sort of infrastructure in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. So this is definitely something to watch out for as well. And a great deal of their economic interest in the region, again, oil requires shipping at this point, is going to involve that kind of paying attention to. And also it nicely aligns with their own sort of naval ambitions, is part of their sort of increasing militarization and capabilities.
Yeah, but I mean, the ports that China is helping build in other places under the banner of the BRI is such a lightning rod for people's accusations that the BRI has military elements to it too, which is why I thought it was so cool to read about the Djibouti port investment as well. And you kind of brought us to the next thing I was going to ask, which is about this idea that China uses a non-interference rhetoric a lot, right? And there's, I find, very little common ground or gray area in terms of assessments between people who tend to think that non-interference is just completely Chinese rhetoric that justifies its engagement with authoritarian regimes versus people who really empathize with Chinese arguments that Chinese non-interference is a novel approach to South-South cooperation. And you kind of highlight Syria. I think one of your articles on Syria makes this point that China chose Syria as a country where it can challenge the United States and the UN with little actual commitment. China can thwart the West and promote its non-interference rhetoric, while Syria could enjoy the largesse of a major world power in a time when it had few friends. So many people, I think, see China and Russia's involvement in Syria as this major moral issue, the quintessential authoritarian regime that people might think of these days. And then there's China and Russia kind of intervening on behalf of what the West sees as like this horrible authoritarian dictator. So putting all that dramatic kind of framing aside, how does Syria play into this question of how concrete is China's non-interference rhetoric and what is China's kind of special role in Syria these days?
Sort of the dichotomy that you've laid out of non-interference is entirely fake versus South-South cooperation is important and China is a leader in that. I think that my thinking on that, at least from this piece, it sounds more like the former. And I think this in the Middle East context for a few reasons. So China spends a lot of time talking about non-interference, and as a point that you can, you know, easily imagine is really appealing in the Middle East, a region, you know, that is often sick and tired of foreign powers. So I've actually heard the comparison that China today in the Middle East is very similar to the America of yesteryear in the Middle East. So we can think about the Middle East as back in the day being occupied by Great Britain, France, whatever, and then the U.S. sent businessmen as diplomats, just commercial interests, right? And so, of course, that changed over time with sort of the geopolitical realities of the 20th century. But China today is framing itself as just a commercial presence in the Middle East, which, you know, it's fairly accurate because China, again, does not want to get bogged down, but it does want to take advantage of the opportunities presented by this market. But despite these incessant talking points, I mean, I think at some point there has to be an acknowledgement that trade and commerce aren't non-interference and they're not apolitical.
That's great.
So you can look across a variety of sectors and see the way that China conducts trade is quite political. So one example is oil trade, particularly when we look at Iran. Iran used to be a pretty big supplier of oil to China, but over the past few years, it's really taken a nosedive, particularly after the sort of failure of the JCPOA. We saw Chinese importation of oil from Iran. It hit a nadir in June, where it imported virtually zero oil. I think about $200,000 USD worth, which is basically nothing. And again, when China stopped receiving sanctions waivers from the United States, it worked very diligently and assiduously to sort of distance itself from that kind of oil importation by decreasing the amount of oil it's importing. It also has taken this other tact of doing these out at ocean ship-to-ship transfers that make Iranian oil look like it's Malaysian oil. Sometimes I think Iraqi oil, but Malaysian oil is the one that it particularly looks like. So the paperwork changes hands and it appears that it's Malaysian oil that when it hits China, when actually it's from Iran. So Iran has definitely become a liability. And you can see that in across business, across oil trade, across telecommunications. Think about, you know, sort of the embarrassment of the Huawei situation with the arrest of Meng Wanzhou for fraud. And that has everything to do with Huawei's connections to business in Iran and the conversation about sanctions violations and importing American-made telecommunications equipment to Iran, which of course is sanctioned. So that, again, I think is just trade is just not, it's not apolitical. And I think the more we have these Chinese multinational companies with brand name equipment, that reputational cost will matter more and more. And then perhaps the idea of trade as just money, just business will take on a little bit more of the nuance that I think it holds in real life. Now, as for China and Syria, Syria is actually a really interesting case because again, China is also has chosen this as a place where it can sort of defy the United States on the UN Security Council. So you can look at a lot of different resolutions that failed to indict the Assad regime, the dictator in Damascus, and China has sort of vetoed that action. What's interesting is that it actually vetoes that action in concert with Russia. And with Russia, which has, you know, a much more adventurous policy in Syria, it sort of skirts the blame from the international community for its actions, whereas Russia sort of takes the brunt and it can keep up its own interests and niggling at the US and then also having this attitude of Western discrimination against figures who aren't from the West. I think that it can definitely have that attitude and skirt international blame. I think, as I talked about before, another issue they're deeply worried about is Uyghur fighters perhaps going to learn from the Islamic State. I actually got the chance to interview the Syrian ambassador to China on this topic, and, you know, really fascinating conversation. And he said, absolutely, we're, you know, when we're picking them up, they're telling us they went there to learn. I don't know if they're picking up as many Uyghur fighters as they say they are. I think he says pretty consistently in interviews about 5,000 Uyghur fighters are in Syria, which I think the general consensus is that that's inflated by the Syrian authorities. There was actually a bit of a dust up a few years ago when a pro-Assad paper broke the news that China was willing to send military assistance to the Assad government. And then immediately China was like, absolutely, no, we're not. And had to work very hard to put out those rumors. For a breath there, people thought, well, maybe China will finally get involved militarily in the Middle East. But we have yet to see that happen in a very public way. But no, Syria is a very interesting case as well.
So yeah, China can, without much skin in the game, can basically make a stand for non-interference without ever actually wanting to pledge boots on the ground or anything like that.
Exactly.
And of course, within this topic of China and the Middle East, we have to talk about Xinjiang. In one of your articles, you write that Qatar is the only Arab country to have voiced criticism of China's incarceration of over 1.5 million Muslim minorities in these so-called re-education camps, while Saudi Arabia and the UAE have actually endorsed the programs as part of China's counterterrorism policy. How do you read this silence? Is it as simple as China's core interests and they give money and have business interests, or how do you read this silence?
So I think there are a few things going on here. And one that I think, you know, the Persian Gulf countries aren't completely without agency in this arena. It's not entirely too surprising that the Gulf countries have been pretty quiet on this. They historically haven't prioritized the human rights in general, or the rights of other Muslims in different crises around the world. They don't have their own stellar human rights record. So the moment they start to criticize anyone of human rights violations, the script can very easily be flipped. And suddenly they're on the defensive when it comes to religious freedom, jailing activists, executions, all those kinds of things. There's also, I think, a lot of fires to be put out in the Middle East. So for example, the Palestinian crisis has become a banner cause, at least in rhetoric, of a lot of different regimes in the Middle East. But a lot of Palestinians actually feel like they've gotten short shrift from the Gulf, particularly in the wake of the new Abraham Accords between Israel and the UAE. And even that cause, those people, they feel cheated, even though this is sort of one of their, in their own backyard, the plight of Muslims. So to care about a largely foreign group of people that they just heard about is sometimes perhaps could be asking a lot, considering what's going on in the region itself. So I think also that's partially by design of China's campaign to sort of sinicize Islam. And so this is sort of a campaign that we've seen recently as part of the discourse on Xinjiang. So there are a lot of state sources on this will call for adhering to local traditions of Islam. Any opposition from Muslims is the work of foreign extremists. And so that is one way to sort of de-link Muslims in Xinjiang from their compatriots in the Middle East and the Arab world. Also, I think one thing that when China talks about Xinjiang, it talks about separatism, Islamism, extremism, and terrorism. So those are all things that these Gulf governments are deeply worried about in their own backyard. So the Arab Spring frightened a good number of these monarchs because we saw all these forces come to light, and then several countries sort of fell into chaos as a result of these convergent forces. So China is pressing all the right buttons in this conversation to keep them on their side. Also, I think that to suggest that, you know, all Muslims, 1.8 billion Muslims, are a complete monolith and should care about one thing sort of strips away some of the nuance and accuracy of that world, let alone the region. As we've covered in this conversation, there, of course, and as you said, Eric, there's a tremendous economic leverage at hand here. China's quite a large investor. It's an enormous trading partner. It's an enormous energy consumer. It doesn't really serve any particular utility yet for the Muslim world and the Arab world to introduce Xinjiang into the conversation. Though I think that people are having these conversations behind closed doors. I mean, I think there's a private acknowledgement of it. Although I think some people also think that it's a conspiracy theory as well. So again, who knows? I mean, there's also this level of economic campaigning, but there's also a soft power campaign. And this was one of the things that I wrote about, is this organization called the Chinese Islamic Association, which it's a state-backed religious organization that China has historically deployed in the Islamic world, beginning with perhaps the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, when China realized that, you know, it is a country with quite a few Muslims and a long history and linkages to the Islamic world. Perhaps it makes sense to sort of deploy these people to represent our interests abroad. So sort of to supplement the economic leverage that they've got in the Middle East, they've applied sort of the work of the Chinese Islamic Association in a great deal of the Arabic language state media messaging that I've talked about already, and then also diplomatic visits as well. Hajj delegations are irregular, of course, and they give some Islamic legitimacy to a lot of the CCP talking points in Xinjiang. So you take all of that together and it's a bit more than just an economic lever, but you know, I don't see the situation changing anytime soon. I'm not quite sure what it would take to change that. We'll just see going forward.
It's such an important topic. And it's so hard, I think, for me, not knowing the region well, but also just being based in the U.S. It just seems like something in which the U.S. is performative outrage at what's happening in Xinjiang. When you said conspiracy theories, like people in the Middle East, especially like at a popular level, not being sure what to think about it, it suddenly clicked to me that, yeah, it's an area in which China can probably lean into that weird tension between U.S. and the Middle East and Western ideals of human rights versus others. It's such a really complex issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I loved your answer to it. Well, we've covered a ton of material, and it's just been really awesome to hear such a well-rounded expert on the Middle East and China. Lucille, we don't have any more questions for you, but will you stick around for some recommendations after this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Just as we wrap things up, I want to remind our listeners that we really appreciate you taking time and listening to our podcast. It's something Eric and I love doing. So if you want to hear more about ongoing news and discussions on the Chinese Belt and Road, and beyond that, China's engagements in the developing world, follow us on Twitter at Belt and Road Pod. And you can also follow us on Facebook. Eric, what do you recommend for us this week?
All right. Yeah, I have two recommendations. First one is a fellow podcast, one that actually inspired me to start this podcast. The China Africa Project had a recent episode. So Eric Olander and Cobus Van Staten spoke with Mark Boland, who's an economist and sovereign country risk professional, on bondholders and the worsening African debt crisis. It was a depressing listen in terms of the debt sustainability and what can be done about it, especially because of a lot of the debt's been of Euro bondholders within Africa. But it's an important listen, so certainly listen to that episode. And secondly, cordless stick vacuums. I got one of these, I don't know why, and it's life-changing. I've never been much of a clean person. It's like a broom and a vacuum all in one, and it's lightweight, and like I've enjoyed vacuuming.
I never have those life hacks that Eric has. I'm going to recommend two different podcasts. One is for people like me who are stuck in the U.S. I try to, you know, migrate back to China every summer to see family and do some work. And couldn't do that this year. Have no idea when I'll be able to do it again. So I've been brushing up on my Chinese a little bit by listening to Chinese podcasts. There's a really good one. It's called Gou Xiong You Hua Shuo. It's called Bear Talk. The podcast is actually just, he mostly talks about IT and operating system app development, which you would think I would have no interest in, but he also like covers a ton of other things like his travel experiences, music, movies. So I've been really enjoying listening to that. And he has a nice reflections on life and stuff. It's just a good respite from current events, basically. And if you don't speak Chinese and or if you just want to listen to something else too, there's a NPR podcast out now. It's called Sold Out. And it's basically on the real estate situation. It focuses on California. It's on, yeah, their tagline is tense evictions and gentrification. And it's super interesting, especially, I mean, I just left the Bay Area, but I think this is something that's resonating across the country. So I really liked that. Yeah. I also recommend, I'm going to put up a dozen links of Lucille's work on our show notes. But Lucille, beyond your own work, what do you recommend?
All right. I am one of many people who are sort of pulling apart this topic. So there are some scholars I really like and you should follow on this topic. Mohammed Al-Sadari is really good. At Beidou University, you've got Wu Bingbing and Wang Sulao. There's also Ariane Tabatabai. She has a great book with Dina Esfandiari called Triple Axis, which looks at Iran's relationship with Russia and China that I just love. There's also Jonathan Fulton, John Calabrese, Jacopo Shita, and more of the like. Bourse and Bazaar, which is a think tank focused on business, particularly with Iran, has monthly reports on Chinese and Iranian trade. And so you can watch that play out in real time, which is really interesting to keep up with. The Middle East Institute also has a fantastic running blog series called All About China that, you know, continuously has very, very good content on this topic and more also about culture and those kinds of cultural linkages than perhaps gets covered in these sort of great power competition kinds of conversations that I think is really important to talk about. Also, you should follow me on Twitter. I am there under Lucille Greer. I try to provide some good up-to-date content. So I think that will be good.
Well, I second following you on Twitter. So keep up with Lucille on Twitter. And what was your handle again?
It's Lucille Greer.
That's easy enough. Lucille, thank you again for joining us on the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you for having me.